Okay, so nice to be back here in the Bodhi Tree Center. I was here last year, and I always forget to make the most of my English accent. Because I'm told in America, English accents make you sound very intelligent. So I should make the most of it. I've seen like some of the American shows, like The Price is Right, and we actually had that in England. And they tried to copy the American Price is Right with the English show. And what they did was, in America, they shout, you know, like, Katie Price, come on down. They wave their hands in the air, leap up and down, scream and shout, and come running down. And when they did it in England, they would say, Katie Price, come on down. And there'd be a little old lady go, oh, I think that's me. And, excuse me, can I get past? And the game show host is waiting there like this. And come on, there's this. So we're not very, we're not as outgoing as Americans are. I'm glad it's a Dharma group and not a game show. Yeah. So sometimes I give talks on, you know, real Buddhist topics, kind of more scholarly talks, and sometimes I talk more on a general level, and there's advantages to both. If I talk purely on a personal level, you know, this is kind of what I've done, these are the lessons that I've learned, so that I would never kind of speak about anything that I didn't have direct experience of, that has a certain beauty and a certain advantage. On the other hand, sometimes it's also good to talk about what you don't know about. A few years ago, I started one series of talks on the topic of enlightenment, and I got a few complaints because starting a whole series of talks saying that I don't know what I'm talking about. But it's useful sometimes to pick up and repeat or consider the Buddha's teachings because he knows more than I do. So I do try and do both, actually, from time to time. So tonight is more one based on my own personal experience rather than based on the suttas. If you really want hardcore Buddhism and suttas, we can do that too. We had a little session a few nights ago on one of the Chula Hati Padmo Pada Sutta, the sutra, lesser sutra on the elephant's footprint. From a personal experience then, there was some years ago when I was beginning to do meditation and starting to come to Buddhism, I heard one talk that was by a teacher. It was called So What? And he did this really good talk that really struck me personally. I can't tell you the details of the talk now, but the gist of it was he listed many, many things, especially about the time when he was growing up, and he always had in his mind this question, so what? And I also have had that same kind of question. In my mind, it's then what, but it's the same question. And so while I was growing up, I would go to school and the teachers would tell you, you know, you get your A-levels, and you're like, then what? And they said, well, then you passed. You're like, but yeah, but what then? Well, then you go to university. Well, then what? Now, there's a story in the suttas of the Buddha's cousin, and his name was Aniruddha. He was the foremost in the suttas for opening the celestial eye, the deva eye, so kind of supernatural vision. And it's said that he and some of his family, when they found out the Buddha had, they knew the Buddha had left and gone into the forest, and it was some years later that the Buddha went back home. And when they found out, they said to themselves, well, some of us will have to go and ordain as monks just to look after him, because he was supposed to be the next leader, the next king. So there was a whole bunch of them sitting there, and they said, Aniruddha said to the others, right, here's what I think. You guys can all go off into the forest and wear rag robes and live under trees and live on alms food and get bitten and eaten by insects, and I'll stay here and look after the kingdom. And this made perfect sense to him. And they said to him, well, what are you going to do then? He said, well, I'll get the harvest in. And, you know, then I'll be happy. Everything be cool. He said, but when you get the harvest in, you have to prepare for winter. And he said, well, okay, and I'll prepare for winter and we'll get everything set up and then, you know, I'll be happy. And they said, but, you know, after winter, it comes spring. You've got to get all the fields ready and ploughing and get the crops in. And Anna was just going, oh, really? He said, all right, well, then I'll do that. You can see where this story is going, right? It goes through the spring and then the summer and then the harvest again. And it started to occur to Anuruddha that there's never going to be any rest. There's never going to be any ease. There's no results. There's no end point in sight. He's always going to have to be working. And at this point, he had an insight. And he said to the others, he said, I've had a really good idea. You lot can stay and look after the kingdom. I'm going off to become a monk with the Buddha. So that's what he did. He and actually there were six of them, including their barber. And they actually made him ordain first so that in the order of the monks that the barber would be above him. And then he went on to become one of the great arahants. Now this also really struck me because it's this same question of then what? Then what do I have? Then what do I get? Then what do I do? This monk who gave the talk that struck me, this is 21 years ago now, he was saying the same thing, going to college and then learning about astrophysics or biochemistry or whatever it was that he was learning about. But one of the problems with science and education is it gets bigger and bigger. It's a way of splitting the world up into finer and finer details, more and more theories, and there isn't any end to it. I knew one doctor, a friend of mine, actually wasn't really a friend, it was just a doctor I knew. And somebody asked him about hormone replacement therapy. And he was quite well known in the district for not supporting hormone replacement therapy. And she asked him, why is it that you think we shouldn't have hormone replacement? And he pointed to a huge stack of books in the corner of the room and he said, I'm not against hormone replacement. It's just I'd have to read all of those books to be able to give you advice on it. So science is like this. It will break up and go into more and more and more detail. So you need more and more specialists. So there is gets less and less an end sight in view when you're doing science like this. There's a few sciences that look for a unifying theory, but not many. Psychology is quite good. It tends to look for a unifying explanation of a human being. It's failed, but it tries to do that. So I also always had this feeling of, then what do I get? Then where do I go? One retreat I did once, and I'm going to tell you anyway, it's a Goenka retreat. And the second day into the retreat, as I'm sure has happened for many of you, into my head popped this beautiful idea of how to build a two-seater hovercraft. And I figured out how to build it out of farming irrigation pipe. And this is a really clever idea. And 5 days into the retreat, the teacher called me over and said, why aren't you meditating? And I didn't have the heart to tell him. It's like, I might not be meditating, but I've got a fantastic hovercraft that I've designed. So in my mind, as the retreat went on, the 10-day retreat wore on, and my design got better and better. And not only had I now built the hovercraft in my head, but I'd bought a farm with a little lake where I could test my hovercrafts. I now had a business where I was making these hovercrafts to order. I was debating whether I should sell them to the military or not, because that would be good money, but then it's a little immoral. And do I design the gun mountings or not? So I was still kind of debating that one. And then on my farm, I was going to plant lots of trees, and then once the trees had grown up, I was going to build all these kutis, which is the word, doesn't mean germs, it means huts, yeah, like meditation huts, where these kuti. And so I was going to build a whole bunch of kutis, and then I can invite all these kind of monks and nuns to come and stay there, and then in the presence of these monks and nuns, I would be able to do meditation. And then I open my eyes and I'm on a meditation retreat. And starting to realize that this so what, when you start extrapolating the stories and following your desires through to the end, very often you just end up back where you already are. I should tell you that this really taught me a big lesson, because after the retreat, I went and spent maybe $4,000 on Hoppercraft parts. And I built this thing, and I never got the fan in the back. I never got the motor in. So all my friends used to call it a craft. Which wasn't very funny at the time. And it's a big lesson, and then I threw it away, because the abbot in the monastery that I was trying to get to, for several years he'd been telling me I couldn't go and live in the monastery because I was too young. And I was getting really like desperate by this time, and I went up and rattled his door and then like shouted at him, look, I've got to come and stay in the monastery for a year. And he said, okay, fine, I was just seeing if you're determined. And like, I was determined. So the hovercraft parts just rotted behind my father's garage. And I often think of this $4,000 and what I could do with it now. The following the lines of thinking can get you into all kinds of trouble and cost you all kinds of money. That was my big insight. So when you follow the lines of thinking of the things that you want, the things that you're going to attain, and you have this question in mind, so what, or then what? Keep following it through to the end. In my mind, I split into two sections, the worldly values and the spiritual values. So the worldly values, if we sum up a human being, one way to sum up a human being, there's many different ways, is according to the senses. We can see stuff, smell stuff, taste stuff, hear stuff, feel stuff in the body, and we can think stuff. Six kinds of stuff. That's a very nice, neat psychological model for you. So what is living all about? Changing the stuff. Different stuff to see. And I know many people who kind of travel around the world and they go and see, in my mind, more stuff, more I stuff. I had an insight into this too, and I was in New Zealand, and somebody took me to see a waterfall, a very special waterfall. Basically, the waterfall came along the mountaintop, hit a rock and vanished. And then you walk down and further around, and then it comes out the middle of the rock face. It comes out the middle of the cliff face. It's a big lot of water too. It's quite a remarkable sight. I don't know if any of you have been, can't remember what it's called, but it's quite a remarkable sight. And we walked down and we looked up at this thing and looked up at it for another 30 seconds. Yeah, then I looked up at it again. And then I found myself wondering what's in the picnic, right? How long are you going to spend looking at the waterfall? I was much more interested in what's in the sandwiches than the waterfall. Now, I've been doing some mindfulness, and this, to my mind, is really interesting. Like, I'd walk for hours to get to this waterfall. I only need to walk 5 minutes to get a sandwich. And yet, I was already more interested in the sandwich. And I told this story a few years ago, and I got all these complaints afterwards that, like, oh, why shouldn't people be allowed to go and see a waterfall? Part of being a human being is the beauty of a waterfall. And I don't disagree, and that's nice. And, you know, last year we walked up Diamond Head, and that was pretty nice. And, you know, walking along the beach and stuff. I'm not saying that you shouldn't go and do these things and that it's not enjoyable. What I am saying is when you're really watching the mind, when you're mindful, what you find is it might not be quite as good as you thought it was. Very often you get into the idea, or better still, you know, you don't sit there and enjoy the view of the waterfall. You take a picture of the waterfall and post it on Facebook, right? And that's your new way, that's the new way of enjoying things. It's like, it's not that the waterfall is great, it's that your 2,000 Facebook friends are really jealous of what you're looking at. So it's not that you shouldn't enjoy it, but sooner or later, don't you get to the point where you're just looking at, like, more stuff, more things to see, more beautiful people to look at, more places to go, more architecture. Now, if you have an interest in architecture, go ahead. I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong with that, but I still always had that question of, so what? You know, so what do I do with a waterfall? What do I do with a picnic, for that matter? And this question was always playing on my mind. And I said this to somebody who came visiting my temple, and they were saying, "Oh, it's so beautiful being around in Thailand, and the weather, and the people, and the temples." And I'm like, "It's just more stuff to look at, and the food." I'm like, "It's Thai restaurants everywhere. You don't need to come to Thailand anymore, right?" And like the weather, I'm like, "Yeah, it's too hot, isn't it?" This is what Australians call whinging poms. Who laughed? There's somebody Australian over here knows what I'm talking about. So I said, like, "Isn't that, that's just more senses to feed. It's more just like other stuff to see, other stuff to taste." I said, "What about something that lies deeper than that or beyond all that?" And she said to me, I'm not kidding, this is exactly what she said to me. She said, "That's brain dead." And brain dead. And I was really quite taken aback by this statement, because to my mind, the spiritual values are something that lies beyond all that. These really are something that's worth cultivating. But she obviously had no kind of idea of that. And to her mind, like, living was, you know, just getting more stuff to eat, more stuff to look at, more stuff to wear. So that kind of really struck in my mind for a long time, and actually made me afraid to teach to some degree. Because I'm always afraid that, you know, when we're talking about Buddhism or spirituality, that some people are going to have this same argument. "Well, aren't you just fooling yourself? Isn't that just brain dead? Aren't you denying yourself pleasures?" To some degree, certainly as monks, you do deny yourself some pleasures, but if you look at monks, or if you've ever gone and lived with monks, they tend to be some of the happiest people. Simply filling yourself up with sense pleasures is not really going to equate to happiness, or not going to equate to a life well lived. Now, again, that doesn't mean that you can't have anything. I say that, and then people say, "You know, look at your phone and your computer and things like this." I mean, I have stuff too, and I enjoy stuff, and I enjoy, you know, people. It's nice to come to Hawaii and see Hawaii stuff and taste Hawaii food. One of the things I love about coming here is you get cheese on everything. So other worldly stuff, money, you get more money. And does that help you? God, what was that saying? If God thought money made you happy, just look at the people he gave it to. It doesn't make you unhappy. You know, there's nothing inherently wrong with money, but, you know, money and wealth seems to be something that really obsesses a lot of people and really drives a lot of people. I'm a pseudo-psychologist in that I did a psychology degree, but stopped there, basically. So I do follow quite a lot of psychology, and one of the reports showed that when they surveyed people and asked them how much money they would need to actually be happy, basically it was irrelevant to how much money you'd got. It was that amount of money plus one third. And people felt that was how much money they would need to make them happy. So even the millionaires, you know, they need 1.3 million. And even the $5 an hour workers, they wanted $8 an hour and figured that would make them happy. So it's interesting that through these surveys, you can see that happiness is always just a little bit more than what you've got. Another survey said, it doesn't matter how much money you've got, so long as you've got more money than your brother-in-law. Which is probably also true. Romance, this is another thing that, you know, I often get accused of. Why should Buddhism lie with celibates? Why should you have to be celibate? Why can't I have my wife or my husband? And there's no reason why not. I mean, personally, I was attracted to the celibate life. Since I was a little kid, I said I wasn't going to get married, and they all said, "Look, when you get older, you'll change your mind." And, you know, like, I'm trying to find them now on Facebook to tell them. I didn't change. Yeah, first time, I didn't change my mind. You were wrong. And then all the people who bring their romantic problems tell me about their romantic problems. And people get caught into these kind of problems. And of course, people always come to the monastery when they're having these kinds of problems. They don't come to the monastery and say, hey, I've just fallen in love, let's go and do meditation. Always want to come and do the meditation when, oh, I'm so heartbroken. How, you know, how does meditation take away my suffering and etc.? But you have to develop the meditation while you're happy, while you're in a safe place, while you can, you know, stop. Then the meditation stays with you while you're going through the difficult periods. Less amusing is when people become sick, and very often you get sick, sometimes life-threatening and sometimes dying, and then also come to the monastery and like, well, tell me about this spiritual stuff. Well, you've lived 70 years before you ask this question, and you can't just get an absolute, what's it called, absolution at the end of, hey, you're off to heaven. I mean, that may work. May work, I don't know, but the times that I've been sick, I've really, really appreciated the body of practice that I've had that I have to rely on. I have a refuge and a confidence and a faith that is based upon the work that I've put in, the hours I've put on the cushion, the books that I've read, the people that I've helped, the things that I've done, that, you know, I feel this is a support to me, and that even if I was to die right now, I would die fairly confident. So that comes from the body of work that you've done. Again, the psychology, there was one person, she was a marriage counselor, and one of the stories she told was when people are having problems with the marriage, they come in and she asked this one lady, okay, think about all the qualities that you really loved in your husband when you first met him. And she said, well, he had a really cool group of friends and he was spontaneous and he was generous. What were the things? He was spontaneous, generous, and very relaxed. That was it. Spontaneous, generous, and very relaxed. And she said, and now what do you think about your husband? And she said, he's irresponsible, he wastes money, and he's too lazy. So you see, these are all the same qualities that she admired in her husband, and now the very things that she hates about him. And then she finished off, you know, the cool group of friends. She said, all these dumb friends keep hanging around the house. So again, you know, the same qualities that you're looking for and that you get excited for and that you want, they get turned around and become a source of difficulty. Hollywood neatly goes past this, because usually the romantic film stops at the kiss, when finally the right guy and the right girl get off with each other and they have that kiss and the fireworks go. And if any of you watch Gilmore Girls, it took 7 seasons before Luke and Lorelai finally kissed in the rain. And it was so frustrating. 7 years we waited for that romantic high point. I have this vision in my head, in my mind, of these cabaret shows that they used to do. We used to see a lot in England in the days when there's only 2 channels, so you know you had to watch that. And they used to have these plate spinners. Have you ever seen that? And they have big, they have these long poles, and they put a plate on the pole and they spin them. And they'll get 30 or 40 of these plates spinning, and then they have to dash from each one. And as each pole starts to wobble, they have to dash over and give it another spin. And that's kind of how I see worldly stuff. Now, you may enjoy spinning plates, and it is enjoyable. I myself have a number of plates that I spin, and you know, I run 3 websites, and I have a group in Thailand, and this year I want to learn video editing, and I finally can say I pretty much mastered Photoshop. I mean, that was a big achievement. So I myself have a few plates that I'm spinning, but I have this vision of like all these worldly values, including these things that I mentioned that I do, is like keeping running around spinning these plates one after the other after the other. And of course, your plates will start to drop. You get older, you get less capable, or a plate that you've been spinning for 20 years, you finally realize you weren't that keen on that plate after all, and then you let that one drop. And I always had this outlook in my mind, this then what outlook of it's running around, keeping things going, but each of these things that I keep going doesn't have a final goal, doesn't lead me somewhere. Now, the same can be said for spiritual values. Spiritual values are aspiration. It's a very abstract aspiration. And a couple of days ago, we were at a fellow called Surya. He had a function out in his farm at Waimanaea. And what he'd done was he'd invited a whole bunch of, I want to use the air quotes here, spiritual people, some Hawaiian spiritual leaders, and there's a rabbi, and there's a Christian priest, and myself was there, and there's an African-American representative, and then there's an American Indian representative. And
I
felt like I was in a joke. There was a priest, a rabbi, and a monk sitting on the stage. Then each of us would get up and we'd all do a little piece on the microphone. Basically what we do is some kind of chant, prayer, or recollection. And it started off with blowing the honch.
Conch.
What's a honch, then? It's not something rude, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Fortunately, as well as my Photoshop editing skills, I can edit audio cassettes as well. Cut the hunches out. And then we had some songs, and we had some Hawaiian dancers, a couple of Hawaiian dancers doing this very nice song that was totally usurped by a little 2-foot-high Sri Lankan girl. While these Hawaiian dancers were doing their thing, which was very nice, this little Sri Lankan girl in this beautiful sari came up and started doing this jig, and that totally stole the show. We don't care about the Hawaiians now, we're just going to watch this little Sri Lankan girl. She was great. And I meant to invite her over for when we did the chanting, and I forgot. And we did a few others, and then the rabbi did his thing, and it struck me that what we're all doing is making some kind of sound, some kind of noise, as if like each of our noises, each of our little songs or sounds is somehow spiritual, and yet we're all making different sounds. And it started to occur to me, this started to feel a little awkward, and then a little false, a little fake, and including myself in that, because it was getting to be my turn to go up and lead the Thai chanting. What occurred to my mind at that point was that song, Kumbaya, Kumbaya, my Lord, someone's praying, Lord, Kumbaya. And I started to think, well, this is everybody's little prayer that's calling something that is very abstract to be amongst us. And the spiritual values are like that. They're very abstract values that are very hard to keep in mind. It's very hard to, you know, you've got like money and you've got like movies and you've got beautiful girls or beautiful men and things like this. And then you've got something really airy and spiritual. Spiritual quality, mindfulness, you know, it's very hard to relate to. And one of the things they do in Thailand for this very reason is when they come and make a donation to the temple, they buy a yellow bucket full of stuff. Has anyone seen that? Okay, and you can buy these yellow buckets in shop. They're always sold in shops outside temples. The stuff inside is a complete rip-off because they'll usually have like a big box of paracetamol tablets and there'll be 3 tablets inside and things like this. It's a real rip-off, and if ever you go to Thailand, be aware. A bottle of water and a roll of toilet paper, because that fills a lot of space up and makes it feel heavy. And then they come and give the bucket to the monk. And when I first ordained, I felt like saying, we actually have enough yellow buckets now. It's not like we go digging the garden or you know, bailing out boats or anything. We only need a few buckets and that's enough. Right? And then very curiously, the one time in our temple, the Chinese New Year, what would happen, people would buy the bucket from the temple, from the table in front of the temple. Usually they're bought in shops outside temple. But in our place, it was in the countryside. So they bought the bucket in the temple. Then they would come and offer it to the monks with a little chanting ceremony. And then the monks would take the bucket, go around the back and put it back on the table. And I felt a little strange about this. And, you know, when you're in other cultures, you've got to be a little bit more open-minded. And so I didn't say anything. I just felt, okay, if that's the way Thais want to do things, I'm not one to go and force my values on them. But they're mad. And then one man came. He was staying in the temple over that period, about 5 days, and he'd stayed in, he'd taken precepts, he's doing meditation. My job was to receive the buckets. Everyone in the temple gets a job, and my job was to sit there for... We had two teams, and we take it in shifts, and we had to cover 12 hours a day receiving yellow buckets. Not kind of the, you know, the future my parents had in store for me. And it was rather hot, and it was rather unpleasant, actually. And then this man came and offered us the bucket, and after I took it, he put it behind me, and he said, no, give it to me. So I gave it back to him, and then he went and put it on the table. It started to occur to me, the Thais knew exactly what's going on. It's not that they're stupid. We'd kind of take the buckets around the back, so it wasn't obvious, but everybody knew what was going on. And the idea is, if you're going to make a donation to the temple, a little bit of money in a box while nobody's looking is kind of the Western way, right? When you donate to something, you don't want people to see. So you want the donation box to be somewhere like a little hidden, and you don't want people to see putting, because that's kind of egotistical. That's like, hey, everybody, I'm the person giving the biggest donation. Look how much I'm putting in, kind of thing. We kind of feel like that. The Thais have a different attitude. They feel that making the donation to the temple is something that you need to make concrete. And that's why they get the bucket. So instead of just throwing some money in a box, they're actually got something physical that they're doing a little ceremony with, and they're actually giving to the monk. And this is the nature of religion, is trying to make spiritual qualities into something more concrete, that you can relate to it, that you can get hold of it, that you can remember it. The Buddha statues are a very good example. At the time of the Buddha, he said, you are not allowed to make an image of myself. There are four things that you are allowed to make. I hope I'm not digging myself into a hole. Four things that you're allowed to worship was relics, Bodhi tree, jetties. Do you know the other one? Dhammacakka, that's right. So the symbol of the wheel. And he said that you are not allowed to make an image of myself. And yet, what have we done? We make images of the Buddha. Supposedly, it was actually the Greeks who came along and brought their tradition of making statues. And so the original Buddha image all had these big Greek noses and these, like, their robes were like togas and stuff. But by the way, if you're interested, there is a story of when the Buddha was in the Tavatimsa heaven teaching Abhidhamma to his mother. And they made a wooden image of him and put it in his seat. This is just for fun, just a legend. And so he came down from the Tavatimsa heaven one of the days. Do you know this story? And as he appeared, this image that they'd put in his seat, this wooden image, actually stood up and started to get down from the seat, because the universe couldn't handle somebody sitting in the Buddha's seat. And the Buddha said, no, it's okay, you can sit there because I'm going back up to heaven. So according to that story, actually the Buddha image was allowed. It may have been invented to justify us having Buddha statues. But this is a symbol. You know, we know that this statue doesn't have anything special in it. It's made from cement, it's made from wood or brass or whatever. Sometimes they have relics and things put inside them to make them have something special inside. But we use it as a symbol because, you know, mindfulness or awareness is really hard to relate to. It's hard to remember. And if you can't relate and remember to it easily, it's very hard to make part of your life. Same with the Thais, with the giving the buckets. You know, it's easy for them to remember doing something concrete in that manner. All of these symbols that we have, I was talking to the rabbi at this long ceremony that we had. We had plenty of time to talk. And he was saying the same thing, that he had the Torah, and he'd carry the Torah around, and people would kiss it. But in Judaism also, that even the Torah cannot be a symbol of God. You're not supposed to have any kind of symbol of God. But we do have symbols, and symbols are useful and they're important. You know, the Buddha image, we make it important because of what it symbolizes. One example is a wedding ring. It's a piece of metal, a piece of gold metal. You know, it symbolizes something very real. I mean, try losing your wedding ring and your wife, you know, she will, you know, beat you. It shows you that it's something that, what it symbolizes is very real. So spiritual values that we try to carry around with us, one of the catches with the spiritual values is they are very abstract, and this makes it hard to, for us to relate to them. Now, because the qualities are abstract, what we tend to do is we have a series of triggers that we use to call up the qualities of generosity or kindness or compassion, which are kind of against the normal flow of getting what you want. We have to bear in mind that the path that we have, the path that we use, is basically a series of triggers. And the path is not, or the thoughts that we have, or the triggers that we have, are not the real thing. What I mean is, you need to remember that we haven't figured it all out yet. You know, you're not yet enlightened. This is one of the things that tends to happen. People get an insight, or they listen to one teacher, and they get inspired. And that inspiration is good. And aspiration to the spiritual qualities is good. But then there's this natural process that starts to clamp you down into various views and opinions. Well, I got this inspiration from my teacher, therefore your teacher is rubbish. And your system is rubbish, or we're Buddhists and we're not Christians, and we don't want to be of this group, and we want to be of that group. And Buddhism does the same too, especially in Thailand. All the monks get on very well together. I mean, we can walk into each other's temples, and I can be welcomed in any temple. And then they say, oh, it's great, we're so glad that you're a monk, and what temple are you from? I say, I'm from Wat Pak Nam, and they go, oh. Well, it's good that you're a monk, you know. And then bit by bit, they'll start to say, well, you know, like, you know, the way that they teach there might not be quite the right way. And then within a few minutes, you know, you're going to get bombarded with their views and opinions. So this is a natural tendency that we also have to start mistaking the triggers for the spiritual qualities that we're aspiring to. Spiritual qualities are very abstract. They're very hard to quantify. But when we start to quantify them or dress them up into teachings, it gets very easy to start to attach to those teachings. My advice is take what's useful. Anything that isn't useful is you throw on the back burner. Some of my inspirations, has anyone read The Cloud of Unknowing? Yes, one or two? Anyone over here? Cloud of Unknowing. Fabulous book. I mean, this, we don't know. Anonymous author. And it's a spiritual, it's a Christian spiritual classic, but this book just made so much sense to me that at the time I was in this habit of using highlighters to highlight the best bits of a book. And it was just every page, you know, it was just covered with the highlights. It was so beautiful. And this is a Christian book, you know, but that really worked for me, certainly at the time that I read it. St. John of the Cross, Ascent of Mount Carmel, anybody? You've read it all? Pretty heavy going to read it all. It's probably only slightly easier than the Old Testament in terms of, but beautiful. I mean, he was really powerful writing. The Dark Night of the Senses, the Dark Night of Memory, and the Dark Night of the other one, the Dark Night of Thought, and then the last one, the Dark Night of the Soul. Dark Night of the Soul wasn't in the Ascent of Mount Carmel. It was a later edition by the same author. So all of these things, all of these teachings, we also need to bear in mind this question of so what? Because you get an attainment, like you get the attainment of the dissolution of the body, if anyone's had that. And the body just kind of, first of all, dissolves into this humming and this vibration, and then you can't tell where your hands are or where your knees are. And then even the vibration just kind of dissolves into just a beingness. And you're like, wow, it's like, take a peek out of one of your eyes just to make sure you're still in the room, you know, because your body has vanished. And that's a real experience. But then if you hook onto your own experiences and other people, and then you say, well, you haven't had this experience there. Well, when you've meditated long enough, then you'll get this experience. Then you'll understand what I'm talking about. And sometimes, of course, people do get the experience that you had and they still don't understand what you're talking about. So I've always been very careful teaching Buddhism, because the more I've done it, the less sure I am of myself in some respects. That is, when people report to me their meditation experiences or something, you know, I really have no judgment. I can give advice according to what I've experienced, but I really don't know what other people are going through. This is why we tend to rely on Dharma and the Dharma principles rather than personal experience to some degree. Otherwise, you attach onto your experience, and then, especially if you're teaching, you're trying to mold that person into having those experiences that you've had. And of course, they may be totally different. Maybe that person should be developing patience or loving kindness. Maybe they'll have more joy with that than bare mindfulness. I like to do bare mindfulness with light. But, you know, some people might not work for. So all the time we need to be keeping in mind that whatever spiritual, whatever meditational experiences that you've had, that also isn't it. That also, you're still not enlightened. You still haven't figured it all out. And if you're coming from this angle, we have this question again, so what? So what? What then? What does this experience do for me? And sometimes you get this really good meditation experience. And actually, I know one man, and he had this experience, not really a meditation experience, but he, for the first time ever, he got himself into the lotus posture and held it for an hour. And he was really proud of himself. And after the meditation, everybody bows and takes a quick toilet break, and he didn't move. And then the abbot comes along, and the abbot was giving the talk, and he wanted something to be fetched. And he said to this guy, you know, Richard, can you go and get me the thing? And he went, no. Because he wanted to stay in his posture. And afterwards he explained that he was so proud of being in this lotus position that he didn't want to go. And the abbot was like, you know, why not? And so somebody else went and got it. So also we have to bear in mind that with all these spiritual attainments then, that we also still haven't figured it out. If you have an experience, if you meet an inspiring teacher, if you read an inspiring book, you still have to bear in mind this so what, so what. So in my answer to so what, I have a few points, which is my own kind of few points that I have as general guidelines that are worth bearing in mind that from my own experience. First one is make it easy, keep it simple. There was a story of Bonaparte, who is the topic of the next talk, and Bonaparte was very good. He's a fantastic general, and everything that he wanted done got done really quickly. And somebody said to him, how do you get everything done so quickly? And he said, it's really easy. When something needs to be done, I give it to the laziest person. So we do the same thing, that if something, when we're working out all of these spiritual teachings, what appears to be the simpler and easier explanation is usually the right way. Because we have all of these teachings, and if you really pick them all up, well, I've got to develop like light casinas, I've got to develop breathing, and on my nose, and on my stomach, and concentration, and awareness, and loving kindness, and patience meditation, and appreciation meditation. And it just gets, you know, a lot. And then you like dissolution of the body, or you know, jhana, or light, or whatever it is, and you know, all these things that you have to develop. Keep it really simple. Be a little bit lazy. Whatever explanation or whatever direction you're going in that seems to be making it easier, seems to be bringing everything together. That's the general direction in which to take the meditation. Intention was my next point. Keeping a purity of intention is very important. Nisargadatta, someone who I'm reading a lot at the moment, because it happens to be on my tablet. At one point during his many interviews, this book, I Am That, which I'm sure many of you have read, basically just very short and sharp interviews with him from thousands of yogis over the years. I certainly trust that Nisargadatta was enlightened, but you can never tell exactly. There isn't a test that you can do to check. But we, you know, we take it that he's enlightened, and somebody was asking him, was pressing him and pressing him, like, and he was very, very abstract. He'd say, well, the self is not something that you can do, it's not something you can make. And this person was pressing him and pressing him, like, what do I do, what do I do? And he said, well, okay, do some mantras. And then they said, do you expect me to believe that mantras are going to get me enlightened? And he said, no, but the intention behind the mantras will get you enlightened. So if the practice that you're doing it with the intention of reaching the ultimate goal, bearing in mind that very abstract, very ephemeris ultimate goal, if you're working with that intention, then what you're doing is sure enough at some point is going to take you in that direction. Don't be content with lesser attainments. This is actually one of the last pieces of advice that the Buddha gave in the Parinibbana Sutta. He told the monks, exhorted the monks, not to be content with lesser attainments. Some of them were having these various experiences of meeting gods and having psychic powers and all kinds of stuff. And he was always the same, this isn't it, this isn't the goal. Don't be content with lesser attainments. Don't be content thinking that you've figured it out, or you've worked it out, or you've found this one little set of practices and that's all the person has to do. Keep in mind that you still, as Churchill put it, keep buggering on, or keep on keeping on. Something that I was talking to with this rabbi the other day, which made a lot of sense too, don't expect it to be peaceful. When you're doing meditation, when you're doing spiritual work, don't expect it to always be nice. The rabbi was telling me this, that, you know, many of his, he would kind of give jobs or exercises or to people in his congregation and tell them to be more generous or tell them to let go and different things like this. They say, yes, but that isn't very peaceful. It isn't very pleasant. And this was something that was on his mind. Well, it isn't always peaceful and pleasant. Very often meditation, when you come to it, you do meditation because you want to have more peace and less stress. Meditation teachers are terrible for this because when we write adverts in the newspapers, we do things like, are you fed up with too much stress? Come and meditate with us. This is the way we kind of sell it. But, you know, very often meditation isn't going to be making you peaceful. Sometimes you're going to sit there and the mind is just going to go berserk. It's going to go crazy. Knees are going to ache, your back's going to ache, you're going to wonder why you're doing it. Don't expect it to always be peaceful. Be willing to put in some work. Be willing to gain insight into the mind that isn't peaceful, the mind that isn't happy, the mind that won't settle down, the mind that is stressful. We can bring awareness to all of these different states of mind. Work on the mundane. That's another one. Because certainly for myself, I always had my head in enlightenment and, you know, people give me books, and I'm like, Stephen Batchelor, I'm like, well, is he enlightened? No. Not good enough for me, you know. Working with the mundane is much more important than working with the supreme. And I still do like suttas, and I like enlightened teachers. But one of the interesting things that I found when I started running this group in Bangkok was, because as an organizer, it's hard to be the organizer and the speaker. So very often I would invite other speakers. So I've invited Stephen and Michelle, a friend of mine, Jeff, and Kama Lekshe, some of you will know, has spoken for our group. And one of the things that I've really found quite beneficial for me is going to their talks, because I'm the organizer, I have to go. And sometimes I probably wouldn't go. It's a little bit far across Bangkok, but I'm the organizer, I have to go, and I really have got a lot out of these teachers. And even though they're also not enlightened, they're not the Buddha. So working with the mundane, don't always be expecting insight and enlightenment and fantastic things. When I joined the monastery in England, when I became a novice, I was really determined, although my abbot didn't believe me for 2 years, but I was really determined to go into the temple and make use of it. And I was really kind of excited, and I was glad to give up my job, and, you know, there's this new kind of prospects of going into the monastery and finally being able to do meditation. And in England, if you want to join for a year, you can ordain as a novice, and you dress in white, you shave your head, and you have a certain number of rules, ostensibly of 8 rules, but actually it's about 80. So it's kind of, we live by some of the monks' rules, but not by all. So you're kind of half in and you're half out. And what they do in England is they say, well, it's 2 years that you do this, and then you can see whether you like it or not. Actually, it's 2 years like that, so they can see whether they like you or not. Actually, it's funny, when I was buying the white clothes, because it was, you're supposed to wear all white, and I was walking around the Indian area in London, and I'd go into each shop and I'd say, I want to buy white clothes, all white, pure white, nothing but white. And then, you know, they go rushing off, they come back with a black t-shirt. And I said, white? And they go, it's got a white stripe on the side, be very good, just try it on, try it off. You know, they were very eager and keen to sell you stuff, and they bring me all kinds of inappropriate things, and it's white, but it's got Adidas written right across it. So I got used to going to all of these shops, and you know, they're always falling over themselves to help you. And then I went into this one shop, and it was this Indian man there, and he's quite a big guy, kind of good-looking, I guess, like in his 30s. And I said, I want white clothes, all white, pure white, nothing but white, no stripes, no labels, just white. And he said, why? I was like, pfft. I did not expect to be asked why. I thought, expected him to run off and get stuff. And I was a little flummoxed, and totally true. What I said, stupid, but what I said was, oh, well, the place that I'm going to live in, you have to wear all white. And he said, are you going to be an angel? Absolutely brilliant. I mean, I get to the monastery with all my white stuff, and the previous novice there was wearing a white sabong. Sarong, sabong, what do you call it? Sarong. In Thailand, we call it a sabong. I think they don't like the letter R very much in Thailand. I get there, and what I'm seeing is I was coming to get enlightened. Buddhist teachings, meditation, the center of a circle, it exists, but it doesn't exist, just like Nibbana. You know, this kind of stuff was what I was after. And what I was given was a white skirt to wear. And being... You know, I'm not, you know, I'm pretty secure in my manliness and my confidence. You know, I'm a pretty secure guy, but I'd also worked as a welder, and I didn't see myself wearing the white skirt. And this was part of the learning curve, to start working with the mundane rather than my head up in the clouds of all these crazy Zen books that I'd been reading. And what is it for like 12 months, which is a Zen practice if you don't know. What I was instead having to work with was having to wear like a white skirt in front of people. When I ordained in Thailand, you see, we actually wear the orange, more like the matte than this color. I put this on when I come here for you, you know, to tone it down a bit. But in Thailand, we wear the orange. And when I ordained, I weighed 65 kilos. I don't know what that is in pounds, but it's not very much because I was always like extremely thin. So there I was in these bright orange robes with my like little pin legs sticking out the bottom of it. And the Thai monks thought of a nickname for me. Any guesses what the nickname was?
Chicken leg.
Thank you very much. But not far off. They called me the flamingo. And occasionally, you know, because you'd never see yourself. And we don't have mirrors in the temple either. I saw a great picture on Facebook yesterday, and it had a picture of a basin in somebody's apartment, the basin, do you call it a basin or a sink, faucet, like unit? What we call a sink where you do your laundry, and a basin is where you do your hands, no? Anyway. Okay, in somebody's apartment, in somebody's house, and had all their accoutrements and everything. And then on the wall, instead of the mirror, was this written in black marker pen, "You look beautiful, don't worry." And I thought that was really nice. Occasionally then I would walk past a mirror when I got to town. You walk past the McDonald's or something, these big mirrors, and then I'd look in and I'm like, ah, the flamingo. It's not the image inside my head. This is working with the mundane, and very much ordaining as a monk is something that like beats your ego out of you, because you know you've got your head in all of these books and enlightenment and teachings, and what it ends up being is like aching knees and learning to weigh the ropes and learning to carry your bowl, learning to white rice and chicken every morning for breakfast for 15 years. Not that I'm bitter or anything. And I never liked white rice to begin with. When I was 6 years old, my brother told me that white rice was boiled maggots, and I've never liked it. So the last piece of advice, increase your dukkha, increase your suffering. And the reason I say this is we need to get the eye for dukkha, the eye for suffering. Now, suffering doesn't mean pain and sorrow and awful things, but you get this eye for the suffering of things that nothing that you can get hold of is really going to be satisfactory. It's always going to be another plate on another stick that you have to keep spinning. So you get this eye for dukkha that you can see in everything that, you know, I can see in everything that I do, there is this dukkha. There is an expectation of failure. There is an expectation of things to break. Now, that's not an unpleasant thing, and it's not a pessimistic thing. To my mind, it's a very beautiful thing, because I do things with less attachment in that way. I can think of many thousands of examples, but we're running low on time. If you have this expectation, that, or this eye for seeing the suffering, the eye for seeing the impermanence in everything that you're doing, this eye for you're trying to create a stable sense of ego, a stable sense of self, a stable sense of your home, and all of these things are the plates on the end of the sticks. They're very unstable and they're going to shake to pieces at some point. There's a curious psychological study on this, and it showed that when people are in great difficulty, they cling to symbols that give more permanence. And this is why in great times of disaster, people usually start turning to religion. And when a tsunami hit Thailand, there's a lot of people turned to Christianity, or Christians who weren't really practicing suddenly began practicing Christians. And also with Buddhists, people were suddenly really getting interested in the temple, and we had all these kind of missions sending monks down. Why do people suddenly start turning to religion? You'd think just when you've been hit by a tsunami, that would be the least time that you're going to start thinking about God. Why did this terrible disaster happen? Or the least time that you start thinking about meditation and temples. You know, you'd think you'd be thinking about rebuilding your house, for example, or getting over the loss of your loved ones. But there is this tendency that when people come face to face with dukkha, with suffering, when you come face to face with your own mortality, when you have an eye for the instability of the world, what happens is you start to really value these abstract qualities that are spiritual qualities. So I'm going to stop there, and I don't have a clock in front of me. I've been kind of looking. Oh, okay. So just 8:10. So I'm going to stop there. Some of you are probably ready for your dinner, your white rice and chicken. You're probably waiting for. So, if are there any questions or comments? Yeah. My karma ran over your dogma. It's true, but I should also say there's a great value in the opposite, and that is also picking up and studying the teachings in their raw form and not as something that we've experienced. So a few days ago, with Tan and Suan and Graham, we had a mini sutta class, and we picked up one of the suttas. And one of the advantages to that is you're getting the Buddha's teaching, not mine. And he was the guy, he was the enlightened guy. So it is good to keep one eye on those original teachings too. Of course, if you cling to it and roll it up and make it into a stick to beat other people with, then that's not going to help anybody. But I do like to get back to those original teachings also. Yeah.